Another year, another housing minister, and another new government housing plan. Later today, the government will publish its plan to address a crisis that's been described as urgent for more than a decade. With the crisis seeping into almost every aspect of Irish life, will this finally address the real issues? It's News Talk Daily. I'm Shane Beattie.
I stand before you humbly and proudly as the 10th president of this beautiful country. The people have spoken and have given their president a powerful mandate to articulate their vision for a new republic. A republic worthy of its name, where everyone is valued and diversity is cherished, where sustainable solutions are urgently implemented, and where a home is a fundamental human right.
As we watched the celebrations at Dublin Castle earlier this week, where Catherine Connolly was inaugurated as the 10th President of Ireland, her opening words struck. Housing was a crisis in the previous president's term, and it remains one as we begin another. But how can we realise that fundamental right she describes and make sure that every person in Ireland has a home? Whatever they're called, Rebuilding Ireland, Housing for All, or today's one, Delivering Homes, Building Communities, each government plan promises to turn the tide, but each one is followed by more years of rising rents, record homelessness, and a market that only works for a few. On the podcast today, we want to talk about solutions, what we need to see published in the government's housing plan, and what more can be done to alleviate Ireland's housing misery. To help us do that, I'm joined by Sean O'Neill McPartlin, who's Director of Housing Policy at Progress Ireland, and by Pat Barry, Architect and Chief Executive Officer of the Irish Green Building Council. And Sean, you'll be delighted to hear, also has a plan to fix housing in this country. Sean and Pat, you're both very welcome to News Talk Daily. Sean, first of all, you might tell us, what is Progress Ireland?
So Progress Ireland is a think tank set up about a year ago. And think tanks are somewhat unusual in the Irish case, but not unusual in Britain and in the US. We see our basic role as kind of looking around the world and finding solutions to various policy problems, in my case, housing, and in others, infrastructure and innovation, and trying to import them and adapt them to the Irish context. So in other words, we see our job as trying to collect ideas and kind of mend them to the Irish case, and then hopefully convince people that these ideas are good.
And as I say, you do have a plan, which we'll come to in a moment, but what are you making of what you're hearing so far about the government's new housing plan, which is going to be called Delivering Homes, Building Communities?
It's very hard to kind of read the tea leaves and what precisely will be in the plan. But I can say at the outset some things I would like to see. So in the short run, I think you're going to have to utilize the buildings that are there already and the lands that's already zoned and serviced, the stuff we have. We don't know precisely how many kind of above the shop units there are that are vacant. One paper called them VATSUs, which is kind of a handy name, vacant above the shop units. We know vacancy is like in the order of hundreds of thousands or low hundreds of thousands, but above the shop we have no data on, so we don't know. But everyone who's walked around Dublin or any other town in Ireland know these are kind of ubiquitous. Getting the rules right on the technical side, on the planning side, as well as the kind of schemes of throwing money at this problem, I think will be very important to kind of unlocking those homes. Crucially, within towns and cities themselves rather than on the outside. So I'd be looking to see, are there reforms to kind of make it easier to comply with the building standards, not by making buildings more dangerous or anything like that, but making it much clearer. If you open up the rules on fire or access, they're very complicated. From speaking to building owners, and there's many surveys out there, it's remarkably expensive to kind of navigate all these rules. And of course, on the planning side too. So I'd be looking for reforms on that. On the land side, we've written about this before, and we've seen noises from the government that they're going to do something on it, which is back gardens, which is allowing homeowners to build small homes, particularly for their own family, in back gardens. We've heard Minister Cummins talk a lot about this. We'd be looking for that to be in the plan, to be part of the strategy. And that's kind of a short-term win for this government.
Okay, and the headline figure, 300,000 new homes over the next 5 years. If I was to have you in here in 5 years' time, do you think we'll see that?
I hope so. I don't currently own a home, so I'm kind of personally incentivized to help them as much as I can.
Yeah, so when you hear headlines like projections from within government of a housing crisis lasting for 15, 20 years, when you're not a homeowner, does that make you nervous?
I think kind of two things. Like personally, I think we have to be optimistic and extremely proactive in trying to solve the problem. But that report, the Future 40 report that you're referring to, the civil service have to plan for all eventualities. So I'm a little bit sympathetic with them saying, look, under these assumptions of demographic assumptions, migration assumptions, and on housing delivery assumptions, this is what it will look like. But I think on the political side, I would like to see more kind of optimism from the political class, bringing forward solutions and saying, look, this is kind of one scenario. We should plan for it. And I think they're right to plan for it. But we should be quite aggressive in trying to make sure a better scenario kind of comes up.
Now, if you were putting together this plan, because I see you actually have your own plan, you have a 25-point plan to build 300,000 homes. We won't go through all 25 points in the plan, but just tell us some of the principles within your plan if you were publishing this report today.
Yeah, so the way we broke down the 25 ideas was under three headings. And the three headings kind of reflect the main bottlenecks that we think are kind of impeding our ability to meet that 300,000 number, which is costs. The cost of construction is far too high. So since 1971, it cost about 45 times as much to build a home today. In real terms, it's about 2.5x the cost of construction. So especially on the apartment side, the construction costs are far too high. So you hear people say there's not enough apartments for sale. There's not enough owner occupancy in apartments. But no one can afford apartments. And that's not because, as some people suggest, this huge kind of price gouging or profiteering. Of course, there's profit in development. But that's because the cost of construction is so high.
Yeah.
So the price of an apartment cannot come below the cost of building it.
So how would you bring down the cost of building an apartment?
There's a few things. So when people hear standards, they kind of get their back up and think that people like me want everyone to live in very small apartments. I don't think there's anything wrong with small apartments. I've lived in very small apartments. But size is kind of one of many things that can bring down costs.
So reduce the size would reduce the cost. Are you suggesting reducing standards would reduce the cost as well?
Well, standards is a big term for like the rules of what you can build and what you can't build. So there are lots of kinds of buildings. So think like 3-4-story walk-ups that can be built around the world. And some of them are quite gorgeous and lovely to live in. I'd be privileged to live in such a building. But these buildings are essentially illegal to build here. So the kinds of apartments we have are very, very nice. They're quite big. They're kind of gold-plated along a bunch of dimensions. And a lot of these dimensions are quite technical and, you know, most people have never heard of them. Kind of being pragmatic about bringing standards to align with what people can actually afford would be the right step. And I'll just say one more thing on this. It's not about making apartments smaller or in some cases people was talking about making them darker. Nobody wants darker and smaller apartments. For nothing. It's about recognizing the fact that the minimum apartment is already too expensive on the cost side for most people to afford. So that's not sustainable. So I know the government has done some things on this, changing the standards and introducing new building types that are not kind of massive 6-story apartments, I think would help on the cost side.
I'm just wondering, and people may be concerned listening, that you're suggesting that we all live in bedsits.
Not at all. So when you kind of think of what are the big apartment buildings being built in Dublin, say, these are huge, very high density buildings. I have nothing against high density, but it's extraordinarily expensive to build like that. Smaller kind of infill apartments are very hard to do, and planning rules and some technical rules make those more difficult. I'd be kind of looking at trying to allow smaller apartment buildings to be built, kind of mid-density. These can cost in the range of $250,000 to build, rather than about $650,000 for a high-density, 2-bed urban apartment.
Right.
So I think that's very important. And to quickly blitz through the other two major headings, the other one is on land. Right now, Minister Brown has introduced some very positive things on zoning recently. I think we need to zone a lot more land. That will come with a lot of infrastructure development, and that's the kind of tricky part. Having a lot more zoned land makes development much cheaper, and it also allows the construction industry to invest long-term, rather than the uncertainty caused by quite scarce land.
Okay.
The other one is on the planning side, which we hear a lot about. Again, the government has done some very good things with urban development zones, which are kind of areas that will get priority, that will have very clear planning rules, and the planning should go through much quicker, and it'll be coordinated with things like infrastructure and so on. So I think that's good, but having clear planning rules where the risk is lower, where developers have more certainty in what they can build and what they can't build, shouldn't be the exception. It should be the norm. So I think moving towards a system where development plans are much more specific and clear rather than a hodgepodge of many different vague rules. If you open up a development plan, it's quite vague. There's loads of kind of aspirations in there, and the developers and the planners kind of read, put them all out on the table and figure out whether this development matches all these vague goals or not. I think it should be much, much clearer.
Yeah. So you say you don't want us to live in bedsits. Do you want us to live in our parents' gardens, though?
Certainly not. So what I want is, on all fronts, from small homes and gardens to apartment buildings, to be ramped up. So I think what people, especially young people, lack are options. They're stuck in their parents' box room, I believe the phrase people use. They're stuck there because they have nowhere else to go. They might have a couple of very, very expensive apartment buildings that they might go to, but the rent is over $2,000 a month, and most people either don't want to or can't afford that. Giving people options is always a good thing, and allowing them to have an option to move into a garden, maybe someone else's garden, that's one part of the increased optionality that we should be looking for. So it's not about encouraging anyone to do anything they don't want to do, but I think it always benefits people to have more options than they currently have.
Well, stay with us, Sean, because I'd like to bring in Pat Barry. And Pat, you are with the Irish Green Building Council. You might explain what that council does, please.
The Irish Green Building Council, we're a charity that brings together all of the players in the construction sector. So that's the largest home builders, the architects, engineers, the research, the universities, the banks, everybody involved in construction who has a piece of developing homes and buildings in Ireland. So we do research, we do education, we communicate, we have certification, certification for sustainable new homes, providing simple guidance to industry on what sustainable building is and how you measure it.
Okay, and you've been listening there to Sean. What do you make of his plan, and is it sustainable, given that that's what your hat is looking at?
There's a lot of points in common there. I suppose one of the first things we talked about was vacancy. I mean, so we do have a challenge in that we have to deliver 300,000 homes. Already, the built environment accounts for over a third of climate emissions in Ireland. And that was based on 2018 figures. And a big chunk of that figure is the embodied carbon of actually building out new buildings. And we're greatly increasing. So the embodied carbon of constructing new homes and buildings is going to form an ever greater proportion of our carbon emissions. Housing policy and climate targets have to go hand in hand, because we can do both, but we have to be really focused on how we do it.
Can we do both? Because I'm just wondering, is the greenest building of all just not to build?
Yeah, well, coming back to Sean's point about vacancy, we recently launched recommendations around bringing back vacant and derelict properties as part of the Vacant Vibrant Building Alliance, which is an alliance of some of the key construction institutes such as the Society of Chartered Surveyors, the RIAI, and professionals who have a key insight within local authorities on the challenges on bringing back vacant properties. There's, on rough figures, we could potentially bring back 120,000 units from that vacant properties and spaces above a shop.
Yeah, which are typically in a town or village centre. Yeah. So it's prime land that people should want to live on if they had the opportunity. What would you like to hear in today's plan that would make you think, right, the government really gets it? They get this joined up thinking that we need to build, but we also need to respect the environment as well.
Well, we're just coming back to the vacancy part. We need to resource our local authorities because it's quite complex, as Sean pointed out. Bringing back these units, quite often there's issues with ownership. The owners of these properties don't know where to start. Navigating planning and building regulations is really complex. They don't have the finance. So we need to set up units within local authorities that are multidisciplinary, that bring together property economics expertise with architects and quantity surveyors to actually activate bringing back these units. And in some cases, you know, there is a viability gap between the cost of bringing those back as units. But we already have a scheme called Croí Cónaithe for new apartments, which bridges that gap. And we should extend that scheme to bridge that viability gap for developers to bring back complex vacant properties within our towns and villages.
It just feels like we're out the wazoo with schemes when it comes to housing. Now we'll move away from vacancy and talk about new builds here. Your focus is on environmentally sustainable building. Are you worried that in a rush to build houses and maybe downgrade standards that we would lose some of that cop on when it comes to building environmentally friendly properties?
Yeah, I mean, we have to be careful that we don't. I'd like to really emphasise that sustainability and reducing carbon go hand in hand with reducing cost. So one of the key areas around planning is that we plan in the right location, that we plan for efficiency. Remember that currently, according to the CSO, about two-thirds of existing housing is underoccupied. So we have to plan in a more strategic way to ensure that anything new we build is actually solving that problem. So it's enabling a variety and mix of unit types targeted, rather than having one headline figure of 300,000 units. We need more granularity as to what type of units are needed for young adults, for those starting out on their life path, for those creating a family, for those who maybe we've had family breakup or single parents, and for people who are looking to downsize. And every location, and as the development plan, it should be actually working out what are the actual needs in that area and how could a more strategic approach help to unlock some of that underutilization. Yeah.
What I'm really hearing from both of you is there's this great opportunity to bring housing back to life in terms of retrofitting. Could the SEAI grants be more to encourage more people to bring property back to life? Is it attractive enough, the grant system that we have, or as part of the housing plan, could we flood the SEAI with more money to give out to people?
Well, it is attractive for certain people who already have the money to carry out renovations, but we need to bridge the gap for those, because there's a couple of schemes. There's a scheme that helps people in fuel poverty to upgrade their homes, but there's people on the edge of not being able to qualify for that scheme. So we need to have targeted schemes that offer more for those on low incomes to renovate.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe the problem is we have too many schemes.
Well, I think it's a rationalisation of existing schemes. And sometimes people are applying to multiple schemes to achieve the same thing, where it may make more sense to have one scheme that tackles vacancy and energy efficiency at the same time.
Sean, what about that retrofitting and to bring some of our towns and villages back to life? Should we give more money out in terms of grants to the SEAI? Would that encourage people to bring these properties back to life?
There's kind of two problems here. One is the government is spending more and more money on housing in general. Housing outlays are astronomically high, over $8 billion last time I checked. And we're not getting a huge amount for that. We're not getting a huge amount of homes. So like on the one hand, I think it's perfectly reasonable to want to support people doing something that is just intrinsically very difficult, which is to fix older buildings, bring them up to the standards that we need. Some people will not be able to do that and we should support them to do it.
Yeah.
But on the other, I think there are ways to get the costs down so the public, the taxpayer, doesn't have to front all of this bill. And those are the things about making the planning clearer, resourcing the local authorities to kind of smooth over some of the cracks. And then I think, you know, there's a Living Cities initiative. As you said, there's a dizzying amount of initiatives here. So I think making that money more accessible and putting it at a point in development where it actually helps you, because some of these, you know, you get money at the end, you have to be quite liquid to be able to do this. So I think, as Pat pointed out, I think rationalizing some of these schemes, increasing them where it's necessary. But I think there's a tendency to just want to throw more money at this problem. And we're not getting a huge amount for all this money the public is spending. And I don't say that because I'm outrageously concerned with not spending money, but it's not politically sustainable. They won't be able to spend this money forever. So we can't kind of design the system to only work when the cash is flowing maximum.
It needs to work at all times. Labour costs. We keep hearing that this is a big issue. It's why property is so expensive. It's why projects aren't getting built. Is there a way of reducing labour costs in particular, do you think?
I'm not sure I totally buy the premise that what's driving construction costs is the wages of construction workers. Irish construction workers are not paid kind of extraordinarily more than other countries, that build a lot more than us. I don't think I buy the premise. I don't think we need to be like particularly trying to drive down wages. If we drove down wages too much, we would also have the problem of not being able to recruit good people into the industry. We remove the incentive to kind of see the construction industry as a nice opportunity for people to work. If we're going to build all this stuff, we need people to start going into construction. And we're not going to do that if we somehow depress wages really aggressively.
Okay, so can I just ask you finally then, both of you, Pat, first of all, for you, if money was no object, and if you could do one thing right now to fix the housing crisis, what would it be?
I would resource local authorities to be able to analyse their actual housing stock so that we get more targeted delivery of housing. We know exactly the levels of vacancy that exist, and then give them the funds to actually set about tackling that.
Okay, and Sean, if I gave you an open checkbook and said this is how you fix the housing crisis, what's the one big thing you would do?
One big thing on my mind is when you build, as this country plans to do very soon, a huge amount of infrastructure, such as the metro, to take a recent case, all the land around that metro goes up in value. And it's kind of obvious why. The metro is nice to live by, so you would pay more to live by it. Other countries, Denmark and the city of Copenhagen does this, Tokyo does this, they use that increase in land value to help fund, one, more metros, more transport, on the one hand, and more homes on the other. And so in Copenhagen, it's the city that does this, and they kind of use all that land value to build more, so it's kind of fiscally sustainable. The other model in Tokyo is kind of private developer model, where the developers who are building the metro are also building homes, and they're financing those homes with the uplift from the metro. So it's kind of fiscally sustainable, but crucially, you get to build kind of at scale. You get to build, as the kind of second clause of the housing plan says, you get to build communities as you go. So I think this model is really important. We don't have an analog of it here. It's kind of mid to long term to set this up in the right way. And there's a lot of detailed choices the government would have to make. But I think that's where we need to be going, which is tying the transport, the planning, the building, the communities and so on with this kind of fiscally sustainable and kind of coherent model.
As long as you wouldn't have to wait as long for housing as you would for Metrolink is the only thing. Okay, thank you very much to Sean O'Neill MacPartlin, Director of Housing Policy at Progress Ireland, and Pat Barry, Chief Executive Officer of the Irish Green Building Council. Thank you both so much for being here on News Talk Daily. We will, of course, be watching with interest the plans coming from government later, and there will be plenty of coverage and reaction on News Talk throughout the day. Be sure to get in touch with your thoughts and experiences of housing in Ireland. Feel free to drop me an email. The address is newstalkdaily@newstalk.com. That's it for Thursday's podcast. I'll be back again with another edition tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.